did, but they're not all here.
That's all right.
Do you want to advance this slide now? All right, well, I think this is it.
Can we wait for Kara to come back?
Oh, yeah, Kara.
She just ran out.
Got locked out.
All right. Well, before I start, I'd like to introduce the mayor of South Bend, Mayor James Mueller, to give a few little opening thoughts.
Opening thoughts.
It's good to see all of you here at the first meeting of our South Bend Planning Commission. I know this has been discussed over many decades, well before I got involved in municipal government, but it was something that became important to help move our city forward when I was executive director of community investment. Let's see, one of my predecessors there. I'm sure he shares in the excitement of having a South Bend Planning Commission. So thank you all for serving on this commission, and hopefully we're able to keep meetings somewhat streamlined and running efficiently for you, so we don't spend too much of your time working on these matters. But certainly glad to have you all, and don't hesitate to reach out to the mayor's office if you need something. So thank you.
Thanks, James.
So the first inaugural meeting.
So this is the first inaugural meeting. This is the second inaugural meeting in a sense. This is the rebirth of the Plan Commission. The South Bend had a Plan Commission up until 1965, in which the city then chose to become part of the Area Plan Commission, joining unincorporated areas of St. Joe County and a couple of the small towns to form an Area Plan Commission. But as we all know, not everybody decided to join that Plan Commission, and so maybe the original goals of what that body was, looking to do didn't quite come through as what everybody hopes. But we're really glad to have you all here, and I personally want to thank you all for accepting this role. You might not believe it, but it's actually hard to put a body like this together and to get people that we know are representative of our community, representative of different skill sets, and people who are thoughtful that we know we can trust to make some of these sometimes difficult decisions. So my name is Tim Corcoran, Director of Planning for the City of South Bend. And with...
Just so you know, we're not doing the presentation first.
Huh?
We're not doing the presentation first.
Oh, we're not?
No, we have to adopt the bylaws first.
Oh, okay. So I'm going to pass it over to Angela Smith, who will adopt the bylaws with you, and we'll go from there. Yeah,
right.
I am.
Right. So actually, Aladine will run the first part of the meeting, I believe, right? In terms of adopting the bylaws and everything, everyone should have gotten a copy of the proposed bylaws and procedures. There were some typographical errors that were highlighted to us, a couple of them. So the first was on the third page, item number 3 under conflict of interest. 3A2, it should have said has a direct or indirect financial interest, not of. And then on page 4, sub item 3, again, it was just changing the word of to or. And then we noticed when reviewing it earlier that articles 7 and 8 were flip-flopped. So Article 7 should be 8, Article 8, so just a numbering issue. So those were the typographical errors we found so far. If anybody has additional questions.
I have another typographical.
Okay.
Article 1, 2, number 2, on all questions of parliamentary law and procedure. So just insert the word of between questions and parliamentary.
Okay.
And secondly, Robert's Rules of Order should be italicized.
Okay.
Second question I have is on Article 4, 1A. Will this be our regular meeting room?
No, it will not.
It will not.
Only on the first meeting of each month, because Martin Luther King observation is always on the third Monday. That will result in us having to move it to the third Tuesday, which is also when the Area Plan Commission holds their meeting. And they've kind of claimed the council chambers. Since they've been operating since 1965, we have to bow out to them, and so we will probably be here just in January. Were there any other corrections anyone found or questions about the bylaws?
I had a comment. This has to do with the amount of time, I believe it's, excuse me, on page 4, the amount of time that during the public hearing that speakers have an opportunity to make their case. This calls for 3 minutes, and I understand why, because having sat through some long hearings, it's not uncommon that people don't need 5 minutes to say everything that they want to say. But if you reduce it so much, it seems to me that there is a sense, I mean, we're supposed to have a public hearing. So it seems to me that people who come, you know, take the time and trouble to come to a meeting ought to have at least the sense that they had an opportunity to speak their piece. Kind of, that's the way we do it in a democracy. We have a chance for people to talk. So I would suggest that we make it 5 minutes. This may not be a huge issue, but it just seems to me that would be enough. Now, there are times when people say that, you know, different people say the same thing over and over again. So that could be a way to restrict. I mean, I think that's a problem, and that could be addressed by the presiding commissioner by saying that, you know, don't, you know, the point's already been made, and you don't need to spend a lot more time making the same point, and that will reduce the amount of time. But it just seems to me that we really should give people an opportunity to make their case.
I think that's a valid point. I think what it raises, though, is that this is a little different procedure than we've had in the past, and I think it's different from area plan. It's based more on the litigation model or the courtroom model, and that is that it's an interested party who has 3 minutes, and maybe that should be expanded to 5, because an interested party is someone with a direct interest whose interest is countable should the matter be appealed. There is then an open discussion for the public at which the time is limited to 3 minutes, and I think that should stay at 3 minutes, because those are the members of the public that may be reinforcing either what the petitioner says or what the interested party says in response. So that might be an appropriate adjustment.
Can a person speak favorably both on both occasions as an interested party and as a citizen? Are they prohibited from that?
Well,
you can only speak once.
Under each section, or?
I don't know. Like, what if they ask a question, though? I don't see why you wouldn't be able to speak in the general public. I guess it's a question for you, Aladdin. If they spoke during the interested party section,
right,
if they were an interested party, and say they asked a question or additional information came up or they spoke, would they be allowed to then speak again at the general public session?
No, that's only for the general public.
Okay, so that is beyond if anybody other than interested parties would speak at that time.
Yeah. I think that's something you should make clear at any.
Yes, it is
at any circumstance, because if it isn't made clear, something,
right,
you know, feathers will be ruffled.
I'm fine with the distinction that you raise about interested parties having five rather than three, and then the general public having three, I think that probably makes, there's a rationale for that that makes sense.
And just so everybody knows, the previous, this is the area planning commission, it was five. The Board of Zoning Appeals is three. So it's been both ways at the county level, so.
How's it been received, in either one?
We very rarely have ever had to cut anybody off, I don't think. I can tell you at the first area planning commission, or the area Board of Zoning Appeals meeting this year that the county held, there was a lot of discussion about it. But I think it had to do with how the attorney was timing them. I think they started timing the 3 minutes from the second they stepped up to the podium. So by the time they got through their name and their address, and they asked a question and the board responded and they kept the timer going the whole time and they cut a person off in that case. So I think a lot of it has to do with how you time. For the most part, I don't know that we ever are super, super strict about this. This usually comes up primarily when we have a large audience. If there's only like two people in the audience to speak and someone speaks for 6 minutes, I don't know that we've ever cut them off. Dan, you can correct me if I'm wrong in your memory. It's usually a tool that we use when we see a room full of respondents and know that we don't want to sit here until 9 o'clock at night. Then we time, and we usually start timing from the time they start speaking, not giving their address and name.
Does the staff watch the timing?
We usually watch the timer, yeah. I like to actually set the little timer so they hear the bell, so I don't feel like the bad person cutting them off. So if they hear an alarm go off, then it just seems like I'm doing something and not them.
I'm okay with interested party having more time to speak. I think 3 minutes for the public, is that pretty much in line with Common Council?
The public is definitely in line.
But could we get a little better definition of the interested party and who will make that determination or how?
Sure, it's actually in the bylaws.
Is it in there?
In here it talks about who interested parties are, and it specifies anybody within 300 feet of the property is the interested party. We'll be able to clarify during the discussion, and whomever's elected president, we will give them kind of a something to share, but we also have rules of procedure available to the public when they come in. And kind of give them the clarification that if you're an interested party, you should have received a letter. And generally, it's pretty obvious because people come in carrying their letters. But we will also have the list available where we will be able to quickly check the address as they give it. And if for some reason we don't feel that they fall on that list, we'll be sitting at the table with Aladine and we'll let her politely interrupt them and tell them they can speak in the next session. So. Is that helpful?
Since that's the first, at this point, only substantive change, it probably would be helpful to have a motion.
I move that we change the time limitation for those who are interested parties from 3 minutes to 5 minutes.
Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Aye. Motion passes unanimously, so the change will be at section 4B, subpart 3, last line, each speaker shall be limited to 5 minutes each. Are there any other suggested changes? Okay, at this point we can entertain a discussion of the rules as a whole, and any concerns or questions that anyone may have.
I just wanted to point out that it's clear from these rules, and I don't remember this from the area plan commission, but it's clear from these rules that we don't have abstentions unless a person has a conflict of interest. So our duty, our job is to vote. So there's a couple of places in here that make it clear that nobody should really abstain unless they have a conflict of interest. So I've just.
Does anyone have a concern about that? Or a problem? And I think
That article said that you're supposed to get up and leave the room in addition to declaring your abstention.
Right. It goes farther than some of our rules of conflict, I understand.
Okay. So as long as you give your notice prior to the hearing, or at the point at which the hearing begins, and leave, everything's...
Is that reflected in these rules?
Yes.
So generally, after the item's read, if you had a conflict of interest, you would notify the president that, you know, usually let us know beforehand. You should always let staff know ahead of time so we are prepared and make sure we have a quorum. But at that time is when you would formally declare that you have a conflict of interest, and the bylaws actually state that you're supposed to say what the conflict is. I have a direct financial interest and may be biased against the project because it's my sister's husband, or I live within 300 feet of the property. And then at that point, if the board, I guess, has the option to accept their abstention, correct?
Correct.
The conflict. And then you'll leave, and then we'll come get you on the hearing.
And if an individual has a true conflict, it's really not for the board to determine that they don't.
So you accept it on the statement?
Yes, you rely on the statement and on the principles of the individual.
I think the statement that Dan's making has to do with the fact that that you can't just abstain because you don't want to vote on the petition.
Right.
That the responsibility of the commission is to vote unless you have a conflict of interest. And since it's a voice vote, usually all those in favor say aye in terms of recommendations. The assumption is that if you don't say nay, that you voted aye. You wouldn't be able to come back later and say, I didn't actually give my voice vote, so therefore I didn't vote. So this is clarified in these set of rules.
And if there is a meeting at which one or more members has a conflict, we have to be wary of the fact that all votes require a majority of the membership to pass. So everyone will need to attend those meetings so you have a clear
quorum's important.
Yes.
Is there a timeline in advance of the hearing that everyone will know so that you can determine that if there's a more than one or two conflicts of interest?
Yeah, so when we send out the final packet, which is about 10 days before, at that point we'll ask you to please RSVP for the meeting and let us know if there was anything you weren't going to be there. That would be a good time to let staff know if there's an item on the agenda that you would have a conflict with, so that we can, when we take a running log of who's gonna be there and who's not gonna be there. And then if we look like we're not gonna have a quorum and everybody's responded, then we'll let you know we wouldn't have a quorum. If you don't respond, expect a phone call from us, so to find out if they'll be there or not.
So any further discussion? I'll entertain a motion to approve the rules of procedure as amended.
So moved. Second.
All in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries unanimously. Thank you. Yep, the next item on the agenda is election of officers. And per the bylaws that you just approved, there are two officers to be nominated and approved at this meeting. One is the president and the other is the vice president. The secretary is our director by virtue of her office. So is there a motion from the floor?
Is there anybody here that served on the Area Plan Commission previously?
Excuse me?
Did you serve on the Area Plan Commission?
I did,
as
yes.
It was previously constructed?
Yes. Yes, I did.
I think you'd make a great president.
Just to get... Who's the president of the Area
Okay, well, just to start things off, I think that would make a good start, because we're also going to be learning this.
So Dan Brewer then is the, and any nominations for vice president?
I'll need Dr. Vernon.
I don't hear any others. Are we confirmed in terms of your office?
Well, no, we're not. There's a possible conflict.
Yes, there is.
That Aladeen is researching only because these papers were given to us by the attorney said that you can't hold two.
Two appointed offices. And we're trying to determine whether a board position is an appointed office.
With regards to Century Center.
So we could vote today to nominate you as vice president. And then if we determine that you'll need to decide about which office you'll retain or vote.
Unless somebody else wants to do it.
I figured you guys would all be chomping at
Okay, we have a motion to approve Dan Brewer as president and David Varner as vice president of the City Plan Commission. All in favor?
Aye.
Actually, did we have a motion to approve it, to approve the?
We had a nomination.
A nomination, okay.
So we have a nomination for Dan Brewer to be president and Dr. Varner to be vice president. Now we need a motion.
Okay, so all in favor?
Aye.
Any opposed? Motion carries. Congratulations. And at this point, the president of the commission will take over.
Okay, so the next item on the agenda, do we need to have a roll call before we go any farther?
Yes, I would advise that.
Okay, I will do, actually, Francisco, did you bring a attendance sheet?
I do, yes.
Would you like to take a roll call?
Yes, John Martinez?
Present.
Scott Ford?
Present.
Kara Boyles?
Present.
Dan Brewer?
Here.
David Varner?
Present.
Marie Miller?
Here.
Kyle Coughlin?
Present.
Caitlin Stevens?
Present.
Okay. So that's nine.
All members present.
Got to nine quickly. So we need to look next at appointing a member to the South Bend Board of Zoning Appeals. So this is a membership position that is supposed to come from the
Mural,
this body.
Right. So the there's two representatives of the Plan Commission on the Board of Zoning Appeals. The mayor has already chosen Dan Brewer to serve as his representative from the Plan Commission. The Plan Commission body should then pick somebody else from the other four mayoral appointees, those being Dr. Varner, Scott Ford, Murray, and Caitlin and Kyle. How do we make them? Oh, sorry. Scott's from Board of Public Works.
Yes, just
sorry, confused here. So Kyle, Caitlin, Murray, and Dr. Varner.
I think Murray would make a great representative. We're going to play a
game. So we have one.
This would be, just so, this is an extra meeting, so it would meet on the first Monday of every month at 4 p.m. It's the same format, same time. And this would hear any variances or special exceptions from the ordinance.
This is a one-year term we're talking about that could be re-elected next year.
Two-year term, I believe.
A two-year term, okay.
The board so chooses to reappoint somebody else.
We have Mr. Miller nominated and seconded. Are there any other nominations? Is there a motion, or do we need a motion?
You'll need a motion.
We do need a motion.
Motion to appoint.
To the Board of Zoning Appeals as a commission appointee.
Okay, we have a motion and a
second.
All those in favor indicate by saying aye.
Aye.
All those opposed, the ayes have it. So Maury Miller will be the commission's elected member of the Board of Zoning Appeals. Okay, next on the agenda is the comprehensive plan for the city of South Bend.
Okay.
Is it warm enough?
Right? All right, well, start over again. Welcome, and thank you very much for being here today. So my name is Tim Corcoran, the Director of Planning and Community, Director of Planning and Community Resources, and that encompasses a wider range of things. Every day seems to grow. So we first started off with strategic planning as being the core team. We then expanded to incorporate historic preservation. That was also a county department that moved into the city. Internally, we also manage a lot of city-owned property, not like your fire stations and your police stations, but whether the city owns residential lots out in the neighborhoods, or the Lafayette building, for instance, is currently owned by the city. The Weather Amnesty building is owned by the city, and our department also looks after a lot of the day-to-day management of that. And finally, the newest element, which is zoning and zoning administration, and which is why you're all here. So, you know, when we were doing this, I said, Mayor Pete, I said, how's things going? As we were putting this together, and I said, well, Mayor, I'm excited and terrified. And he said, those are probably the two appropriate feelings to be feeling right now, because, you know, this is not a small task. And we'll get into some of those details, but part of the day-to-day, the people that you'll be speaking with the most, the people will be helping you out the most, and the people who, if you have any question, please reach out to Angela, as you've just met, Joe Molnar, who is the zoning specialist, Francisco Garcia, who is the administration part of this, the admin assistant. These people, especially Angela and Joe, when it comes to like the rules or the regulations or what they know what they're talking about. And the reason they know is because they helped write the new zoning ordinance that you'll be working with. But we also have a broader team. It's Mike DeVita behind you, some of you may know. Liz Meredith is a principal planner. Chris Dressel is not here, but another senior planner. Dave Rilos works as property development manager. Andrew Netter in the back does property development, as well as a lot of our GIS mapping internally within our office. Alicia Fiesel, HPC, and Adam Turing, HPC, in the back. So this kind of rounds out the entire sort of planning team. So the thing that guides all of our decisions as staff, and ultimately your decisions as plan commissioners, is the city's comprehensive plan. This was adopted in 2006, and it's still got a few years of life left on it in terms of what its expectations were. But this is the guiding document for the city of South Bend. It contains a whole lot of goals and objectives and policies, and when we are considering decisions that we have to make on rezonings, for instance, you know, this is the core document that we go back to help us make our decisions. But every year, and we do neighborhood plans, and these are some examples of neighborhood plans. When those neighborhood plans are completed, and oftentimes then what we do is we have council adopt these plans. And these plans will also be adopted by the Plan Commission, by you. And so what that means is these become like an addendum to the plan, to the comprehensive plan. So it updates that comprehensive plan, but just for a specific area of the city. So sometimes we have neighborhood plans for parts of the city, sometimes we don't. If we do have a neighborhood plan, we start there. And if the neighborhood plan doesn't help us answer that question, we move up to the comprehensive plan. And if there is no neighborhood plan for that area, we'll go straight to the comprehensive plan to help us make our decisions. I want to get into a little bit about the zoning ordinance that you guys will be helping to administer. And when we started this process of updating this ordinance, we started about almost 3 years ago now, incrementally changing the ordinance, sort of one sort of rule or a couple rules at a time. And we didn't exactly know what the end goal was going to be, and But we did know that there was a series of values that we wanted to promote, that this ordinance needed to help deliver. And the ordinance, again, is also kind of it's the implementation side of the comprehensive plan. Okay, so taking a lot of the goals and objectives from the comprehensive plan and trying to carry those out through the regulation and the rules that we have in front of you. So back in 1928, when this picture was taken, South Bend was a very urban place, and a lot more buildings, as you can see, a lot less parking lots. The taxable value that's on this map is huge compared to probably what it is right now or what it would be. And so what we know is that the city became what it is today and is resilient because of its urbanism. And we also know that those values lead to value. And this is a map that was done in 2016. It's the value per acre map of South Bend. You can see where downtown is. It's all the purple, it sticks out. And it's because it's the most valuable land in all of St. Joe County. At the time, the DoubleTree Hotel was delivered a per acre value that was enormous compared to places like University Park Mall or other places. And when we started looking at things in this way, you could start to see that urbanism really drives the value of our community. Corby's, for instance, is worth 1.5 times per acre than University Park Mall, just as a little thing to think about. And then, so it is that urbanism that helps drive, and it's what we need to pave our roads, to fix our pipes. Karen knows all about this, and we always are struggling with how we get this to work. So we need to really focus on re-urbanizing our city and making sure that we think that way. So, you know, our city grew, right? It grew through this industrialization, came up to its peak, but as you all know, Studebaker, the main driver, it closes. Same time, suburbanization kicks in the United States. This is, you know, and people started leaving urban areas, moving out to the suburbs. And what happens, right? Our population begins to decline. But in 2010, we started to see a corner. We started turning a corner, maybe. You know, there's a shift where people are starting to move back. There is a desire for walkable places, and people want to live in those places. We're seeing new housing, whether it was downtown and renovated buildings like the LaSalle Hotel or the Transpost site, where there's new single-family housing happening. The other key value that we look at is incrementalism. Resiliency of a community and of a place is done in small pieces. Much like the way we brought this zoning ordinance through council, which was one little piece at a time, it helped us test ideas, it helped us socialize ideas, and these little increments are what makes neighborhoods strong, what makes our downtown strong. And so one of the things that we wanted to bring forward through these zoning ordinances was allowing and even promoting this idea of small steps getting to something bigger. And you can see a lot of that work on Western Avenue. It's a great example of where that incremental approach is really starting to recreate a place. The other, urbanism, walkability, and infill development, two huge elements of what we're trying to accomplish. This is called the urban to rural, or rural to urban transect. It's a kind of a planning term that was developed by, I guess it was DPZ in Florida. And the idea here is that this is sort of a cross section through our community. And over on the left, you've got farmlands or the rural areas and forests. And as you move through, you've got rural neighborhoods, suburban, all the way up to your downtown. And so this zoning ordinance really focuses on these last three parts of the rural to urban transect, which is that more urban areas. And repairing our neighborhoods is also another thing that we are very focused on trying to do. The zoning ordinance is one element of repairing our neighborhoods. It is the regulation that guides development. It's only one section. There's a lot of other pieces to this puzzle, but it's good to get the regulation right in order for us to help promote the ideas that we're trying to achieve. And one of those ways is through a variety of new, not really new in a sense, but expanded set of housing options that weren't necessarily available, or at least easily available under our old ordinance. Missing middle housing is one thing. I'll get into it in a second. And ancillary dwelling units is another. So this new ordinance, one thing to note is it allows by right an ADU, an ancillary dwelling unit, on every parcel of land in South Bend. So every residential parcel in South Bend can put a granny flat in the back. There are certain regulations that tie into that, but you can also do one on a commercial property. You can do that on an industrial property, anywhere in South Bend. And there's certain rules that we can get into that with you, but this is one big step that a lot of other communities around the country are struggling to do, and they need to do it more than we do because of having a lot more pressure on their housing market from increased population. Missing middle housing, this diagram you may have seen before. This is done by a company called Opticus out of Berkeley, California, who have done, they helped us on our NNN plan, for instance. And through that plan for that neighborhood, they also tested a lot of housing options that helped us tune this ordinance to be very South Bend specific. And that's a really nice thing about this ordinance is like any other community in Indiana can't necessarily pick this up and apply it to their town. It probably won't work. This is really tuned to South Bend. It's very South Bend specific. There's a lot of ideas out there that you could grab definitions and things like that, but overall, it's a very South Bend document. So missing middle is, everything to the left of that red line is single family houses. That these are just the things that you're very familiar with. The districts in the new zone, or the new zoning ordinance, is called S1, Suburban 1, and U1, Urban 1, and Mike will get into what that means. And actually your handout starts to show how we've set our zoning ordinance up to sort of reflect that rural to urban transect. So on the left of that diagram is the sort of, you know, the least dense, and as it moves to the right, it gets denser. To the right of this line is, you know, your more mid-rise buildings, and these fall into S2, Suburban 2, which is a multifamily suburban zone, kind of like Irish Hills. Is that kind of an example of that? U3, which we'll get into in a second, UF, which is Urban Flex, Neighborhood Center, and Downtown. But what our zoning ordinance didn't do very well was this place in between, okay? And this is sort of, we've added a level of subtlety in a way to our residential districts that allow us to do more creative housing options. You know, fourplexes, triplexes, duplexes, cottage courts, a lot of other things. And what this allows us to do is we can put four dwellings plus an ancillary dwelling. That's annoying. All on one lot. So currently
we're working on improving the technology in this room too. Yes, as we're improving.
Yeah. One of the things about the U2 district is that there isn't a lot of land in South Bend zone that way at the moment. But as part of the zoning ordinance adoption, we also had to adopt a zoning map. And where we've had recent neighborhood planning efforts, like in the NNN or the Southeast Neighborhood or the West Side Main Streets plan, we took the information from those plans and we zoned those areas to match the plans that had been developed for those areas. So, one of the things that I know when, like for instance, when Scott was here, when you did the West Side Main Streets plan, one of the things that didn't happen was sort of the mass rezoning of a lot of, well, that's been done. And we've also incorporated in those two neighborhoods I mentioned more of that U2 district, so people can capitalize on that right away.
And it's something we'll probably continue to do as we bring comprehensive plans through the Planning Commission, the City Council. It's just a tool that hasn't been used very much that we think we'd like to kind of incorporate. We think we may be overheating.
Quick question, and I can hold this till later, but just with the rezoning, impact on individual property in terms of, is it that, is there coming forward, they have an option between the two or sort of grandfathered in until there's a change of ownership, or what's that like for a individual property owner whose land is either upzoned or downzoned, so to speak, in terms of when you look at the new, like, as it fits into the form-based code compared to where it was before?
So 95% of the properties were straight translation. So at the beginning of the zoning ordinance, there's a nice little chart that says if you were SF1, the straight translation is S1. Mm-hmm. And 95% of the properties fell into that. The other 5% that didn't, we sent them a letter prior to the adoption. So we sent them a notification that we were proposing to change other than their direct translation and gave them the opportunity to respond. I think we got over 100 calls from those letters, but only like 3 changes resulted from it, because most of it was people didn't understand what was going on. So as of January 1st, our zoning district has changed. There's no, like, their use might be grandfathered, but the zoning district's set. So, and they, our director's not working, we can talk a little bit about that.
And that's a great segue, by the way, because here's the new zoning map. And I'm gonna pass this over to Mike to discuss this.
So as Tim mentioned, probably the most important planning tool we have is the zoning ordinance and its associated zoning map. And primarily what the business of the commission is to determine changes to that zoning map of moving properties from one district to another. So we just wanted to cover, give a quick overview on what the districts are, so we have a good baseline understanding of that. So our ordinance is kind of set up as Tim described, on the rural to urban spectrum, but obviously for looking at South Bend, starts with the suburban. So we have 12 zones in the zoning ordinance, so 8 of them fall within that spectrum, which are standard districts. Then we have 4 special districts, I'll get to why those are there. So again, generally as you move from left to right, then becomes more urban, generally some more complexity in terms of land use, like greater intensity. So our first two are our two suburban zones, the suburban neighborhood one or S1 district would be primarily single family residential neighborhoods near the fringe of the city. So maybe one's off of Brick Road to the north, or Lafayette Falls on the south side, or housing around the fairgrounds are examples of S1. S2 is the suburban kind of multifamily, primarily. So again, some like Irish Hills, but it could also be a little bit smaller format, like a Walnut Grove could fall in that zone as well. Then we move into the urban zones. U1 is would be what's primarily a single family residential neighborhood for urban areas, so it tends to be housing that's pre-World War II. As Tim was talking about, urban neighborhood 2 is kind of the next step up, so this would be anywhere from 1 to 4 units allowed on a lot, so it could be a mix of single family homes, duplexes, maybe small groupings of townhomes. It tends to be in the neighborhoods that kind of immediately ring down the town. Ones where you saw that as a traditional pattern, where you have single family home, duplex, single family home. It's kind of that range of housing, but which is of a kind of a smaller, kind of master scale. Then the step up beyond that would be urban neighborhood 3. So U3 is more of a straight multifamily, at least allows up to that. Most of these kind of build on one another, where most of the things that are allowed in lower zones or less urban zones would also be allowed there. So this would be for larger urban apartment buildings. And then urban flex is the next one, UF, that would allow small commercial uses to be introduced. So there might be a small office on the ground floor. It could be kind of your kind of isolated corner store that you see around the city. And this is also to give some flexibility. You see, especially along some of the major streets in the city, you'll have a, it might be a house that might migrate to the insurance agency, or then it might migrate back to a house. And in those cases, we think we're fine with it being either way, rather than going through a whole series of rezonings. It can live at an urban flex, so it can be one or the other or both at the same time. Then the next one up would be a neighborhood center. So that tends to be kind of our traditional neighborhood business districts or mixed use areas. So that could be places on like Miami Village or along Western Avenue or Mishawaka Avenue, or at the high end of the intensity scale, like 83 Commons would fit into that neighborhood center classification. Then the most intense standard district then is downtown. Grasp what that's about. Then we have four special districts where the land uses don't really fit well on that rural to urban spectrum. First one is open space. That's primarily for, exclusively for publicly owned parks and open spaces. So one, unless John's doing a project, probably won't see much activity in front of the commission for. Then free university to, with universities having a kind of unique land uses there to allow for their development. Then the other two special districts are commercial. This tends to be suburban commercial, a little bit more strip development that we see. So Long Island Road or say Portage and Cleveland area would be the zone C. So it tends to be commercial, exclusive commercial, more outlying areas. Then finally have an industrial zone. We have within the zoning ordinance then a table, so we have you'll find if you want to dig into the zoning ordinance, each of these lines is a land use, each one is defined within the ordinance. And then this is the table that shows the districts atop on top then where each of those land uses would be allowed. So I think we've hit all grouped all the land uses into 66 to keep it simple. A departure from our old ordinance, but I think had about 500 land uses listed. Okay, I'll go back for a second. So then you can kind of see the pattern again as it generally kind of builds as you move through the standard districts.
Mike, does that exist online or?
Yes.
Okay.
Yep. Yep, it exists online. The entire ordinance is online for
publishing. Is it still draft?
It's South Bend draft form? Gov, no, the adopted version is okay. Online. So southbendin.gov/zoning. And mine didn't drop mine for you this time, but like this is what we had before. Mm-hmm. And Scott Ford's is actually probably better than mine because mine's got extra thing in here. But you can see we went from this to that. So hopefully your meeting's looking a little bit shorter as well with that.
But yet introducing new concepts that help like actually drive a better outcome. So while we've reduced a lot of stuff, we've added some things to, because we're very outcome oriented in a lot of this. So it's definitely a big accomplishment that Mike did a huge amount of work to put together.
And the online version, it's all hyperlinked too. So every time we refer to a different section of the ordinance, you click on it and it takes you right to that section. Unfortunately, the back button doesn't work as nicely, but it does get you at least to that page, so you have it all on there. So that's another huge usability upgrade for the ordinance.
Well, if you're only looking to become somewhat of a zoning expert, Angela here will talk you through of how, when we have business before the commission, how we evaluate those proposals and what we present to you.
So before you do that, when you describe these areas, let's take the university area and you draw that as a boundary. Do you draw the existing boundary or do you then include two streets on either side?
So the zoning ordinance only applies to privately owned property, so okay. It doesn't include the right-of-way. So okay. We defer to the Board of Public Works for anything. So, you know, say a sign happens to be in the right-of-way,
yeah.
The zoning ordinance does not apply to that.
Well, I'm thinking more in terms of when you draw the city Ross only met for the state.
So all the parcels, all 46,000 plus parcels that we have in the state have a zoning designation assigned to it. So it's based on the parcel boundary.
But on the, okay, on the boundaries.
So every parcel is individual, so it's not necessarily like a clean little line. So anything zoned U University is probably either owned by Notre Dame or IUSB. So IUSB also owns land that's not zoned U University. So they may at some point want to expand their campus and come and rezone several parcels to.
But until it's part of the campus, it remains.
Whatever the current zoning designation was as of January 1st this year. So every parcel gets a new designation, or got a new designation for January 1st. Yeah, yeah.
And looking at this, and seeing that the categories, they appear to me to be, just at a glance, to be much more open than the old zoning ordinance. Open in the sense that people can do more with their land than they could under the previous zoning ordinance. So that might mean that we won't have as many petitions.
It might mean you have less work. So one of the text amendments that
it was a goal of ours.
We're not trying to put you out of, like, you're, we don't want to miss you guys every month, but we would much rather talk about bigger topics and talk about other ways that we can improve the ordinance. I mean, ideally, if we got the zoning map right and the zoning ordinance districts are correct, then the Board of Zoning Appeals won't have very much work and the Plan Commission won't have very much work in terms of changing zoning districts unless we have really exciting projects. That then gives us the opportunity to say, what else can we do? What are some other current trends that we can incorporate? How can we change our ordinance to keep making it better? Mm-hmm. So we don't expect we'll be canceling this meeting much, because if we don't have a lot of rezonings, then we're going to start exploring some exciting ideas for the city beyond what the initial zoning ordinance does.
So in S2 here, an apartment house is a permitted use in S2.
So that's a building type, and I'll kind of tell you a little bit different. So
what if somebody wanted a whole bunch of units? I mean,
so multi-unit residential is allowed in that district by right, so they could build an apartment complex.
With lots of units?
With lots of units. So that's S2 is the equivalent of what would have been our MF2 district.
Okay.
So our suburban multifamily district before. And there is a chart at the beginning that kind of tells you what those translations kind of come up to you for those 95%. But S1 is generally what would have been the SF1 district. MF1, that's all right. MF1 became the U3 district, so there's not quite as, it's not the same spectrum because they were set up a little bit differently, but that is at the beginning in the first chapter of the zoning ordinance, so
it's okay.
I think though that the parameters for the lot in terms of coverage would be a natural governor on the density.
Okay.
So
okay.
Yeah. You still have setbacks.
Yeah.
Okay.
One question I had was just the distinction between UF and U3. Just why that was broken out, just out of curiosity. If it's just the notion of including the possibility for the mixed use, just what was it? That may come up, I think, of the one.
Yeah, essentially UF is U3, but allowing some small commercial uses in it. This ends up in the county, but I think there's the overlook. This is mm-hmm. the apartments that are east side of Twickenham, adjacent to the Notre Dame campus. And then, for instance, they put the little cafe or mm-hmm. brew pub space in there. In terms of square footage, it's probably like 2% of the building. But for instance, when they look at it from the county perspective, there was not a good mechanism to cover something like that. And even in the city, there would not have been without going to like a what was then the mixed-use category, or would be neighborhood center in the new zoning ordinance, but functionally that's not what it is.
Mm-hmm.
So it's allow some flexibility there for those small uses, and back to some of our traditional pattern has the small kind of corner store of kind of one-off sort of commercial-related uses.
What's in U3 that excludes, like what's a neighborhood around here that we would recognize that excludes it?
So again, you three might be like the apartments at the corner of Colfax and Eddy, or the Gemini apartments, a true just multifamily. And then the UF is kind of a transition between just true multifamily, but not quite as intense as neighborhood center. So not quite as many commercial uses allowed within it. And so it's kind of more equivalent to what used to be our OB office buffer district, where you kind of had this in-between, kind of could be a house, but could be an office, maybe both, maybe a small. The only difference between this and the OB is this will allow for some small scale retail, which wasn't necessarily in there. So this could be literally like the little grocery store in the that you might find in one of the middle of one of the West Side neighborhoods, where you have a little grocery store in there, and somebody lives above.
So that is the assumption then that it was pulled out from U3, perhaps to maybe drive away from having that occur mid-block or something like that? Because otherwise you would think that that's sort of one and the same, right? The U3 and 5.
Yeah,
so you're just trying to have the mixed-use stuff on corners or intersections or something like that.
Well,
no, that's the difference between probably U3 and neighborhood center. Yeah. So neighborhood center would be more at the nodes or at the corners.
A lot of times, especially like, and I think of Ironwood, parts of 23, parts of Jefferson, where the nature of the street, which used to be probably all single family homes mm-hmm. in the past, that's how it was originally built. Because the street now carries a ton of traffic and the desirability of it being a house, it is dropping, but the desirability for a dentist office is increasing because you've got the traffic going by. That this allows that flexibility so that the neighborhood, which usually just sits one lot, behind that corridor, can continue to be, won't be downgraded or hurt or by some sort of new commercial development that wants to take advantage of the movement economy of that corridor, and instead it helps preserve the neighborhood character by providing that area in between what is purely residential versus full-on commercial or full-on mixed use or multifamily. We might explore through neighborhood plans upzoning things around a corridor or certain parts of a corridor that might go to mixed use or multifamily, but or neighborhood center.
So you might see, for instance, on a new plan, you might see neighborhood center right at the intersection of two streets. You might see urban flex in between those two streets, and then maybe one block back you might see the U3 where it starts to get into some of the higher density residential. So you might be U2 or U3 a little bit kind of off the corridor, for instance. So it's just kind of a transition.
Mm-hmm.
Because this isn't true form based, it's also a transition of uses. So if you look at the use table, you see that things kind of get a little bit more more developed in there.
Thank you. I can imagine if there were, to extent to which there might be a question on it, something coming forward this year, this is the chance to speak to it.
So I just want to quickly go through kind of what happens when somebody tries to develop their property and what we do before we get to you guys and where you pick up. So when someone's looking at a property and they contact us and we find out that maybe it's not zoned properly for what they want to do, or now that you guys are reviewing subdivisions as opposed to that going to a plat committee, somebody may contact us and say they're subdividing the property. We always try to encourage people to meet with us ahead of time, primarily because we use the combined public hearing procedures. So if they're already going to come to us for a rezoning, we want to also try to look at their project and see if we can handle some of their variances, if they might have any at the same time, but just also to make sure that they're getting the right category so that they're not asking for a super intense category when they might be allowed someplace else. So we're always going to encourage that they go to the district at which they first appear and not zone to something more intense than they have to be. So we always encourage to meet with them ahead of time. We then, once they file, we'll start looking at kind of the history of the project, if there's been rezonings in the past, variances in the past, or something along those lines. And then I guess after the first point, we're really assuming that they filed with us. We then meet, we send this out for review from engineering and the fire department, but there might be other agencies that review this. NDOT doesn't like to give us comments, so we don't expect we'll hear from them too often, but occasionally we might have something that kind of gets elevated to their thing. We're also reviewing it internally as a staff and providing feedback to the petitioner. If there's anything we notice on the petition that might be correct, maybe needs to be corrected, maybe they put the wrong zoning designation or they forgot to include a parcel on there. We handle all the ordinance preparation with the council and handle all that stuff, so we're working with them in the background of that. And when we're working on coming up with our staff recommendation, we're going back to those criteria that KK covered with us in the training and looking at those in conjunction with all of this. All of that comes down to a staff report that we will send out to you about 2 weeks beforehand. This looks completely different than the Area Planning Commission one if you've seen them in the past. Like the ordinance, we're trying to kind of hit stuff a little bit harder. So we start right away with calling out the property information. So this is going to be the location and the owner. We ask on their petition for them to provide us a project summary. So this is going to be a summary of the project in their own words. So we've given them a limit on how many characters they can use, because some people would probably go on for 2 pages and all they're really saying is we're building a hotel. So we are probably going to keep that at their own words as much as possible. And then breaking down the requested action. Are they asking for a zoning? Are they doing a combined hearing and asking for a zoning and a variance and a special exception? So it could be any combination of things. The subdivision staff report looks slightly different, because this is where we'll highlight kind of like how many lots they're asking for and everything like that in this section. We'll give you an aerial that gives you kind of context of where it is and highlights the property, and then the site plan. All of this you guys will have already seen once, because when we get a petition in, when we're sending it out for the agencies to review, we're also sending it to you guys as a preliminary packet. So if you want to visit the property ahead of time, you can. But you know, this is really the detailed once it's already gone through our work over. Again, we follow the state criteria. So we'll have a section on the current land uses. It automatically pulls in the district intent, just to remind you what the intent of the district is that they're asking for, and some analysis around there, and gives us a place to have any comments from engineering, fire department, or anything else that may relate to the property. And then the criteria for decision making, those are again the ones that KK went over. We are asking them to provide those answers. I would like to say they get it right and we could just copy and paste what they say into here, but sometimes they may not pertain to the actual question asked, or it might kind of go off rails. So this is kind of what you'll see in the staff report is our answering of those questions. We refer back to what they say quite a bit, but this is really our analysis. So we're addressing all of those criteria to help give you what the staff's opinion of those criteria are, and then a full analysis and recommendation. So this first page, if you saw nothing other than this first page, you would still be able to act on it, because it gives you all the information in our recommendation. But the subsequent pages give you all the details of how we got to the point that we got to in terms of our recommendation to you. In terms of your responsibilities, again, KK covered most of this, but just to reiterate, you'll get that preliminary packet that gives you a chance to read over the petition and kind of get a general idea of what's coming up the next month. We encourage you to visit the site. We know you may not always get to do so, and we will bring pictures and everything in case someone's not out driving around looking at these, but in general, they're going to be areas you're probably already familiar with. We'll send you the staff report, so we kind of expect that you've read that when you come in so that you know what we're talking about. And we encourage you, when you get that staff report, if you have any questions, don't hesitate to call us. There's no dumb question, especially as we have a new zoning ordinance, new plan commission, new rules. You're welcome to call us. You can't call each other, you can't call the petitioner, but you can always call us and we can get you the answer, or we can answer why it's being zoned a particular way.
Can you repeat that? Who can't you talk to?
Anybody but us. I suppose you could call Aladine. She's considered her staff too. But most of the time people would call us, and then I'll call Aladine and be like, they're asking if this is legal, and what do you think? So, and then when you get to the meeting, by that point, I guess the general assumption is that you're not making a decision until you have the public hearing. And that's the way we're supposed to do this. So you've had the information, you have the base information, and then we listen to the public hearing, the public testimony. You get a chance to ask the petitioner question, ask us more questions if you want to, and then you'll go on to the voting. As Aladine mentioned, the public hearing procedure is a little bit different now than it's been in the past. And this follows the court model, and She can, I'm sure she can tell you all about that. I won't bore you with all that right now, but it's a little bit different. So the secretary will read the petition title. We will give you a staff presentation. We will not regurgitate the entire staff report to you. I don't like to read you documents I've already given you, so we will give you a quick summary and our recommendation. You can ask us any questions that you may have for us, and then we'll have the public, the quote-unquote official public hearing. The petitioner makes a presentation. Anybody within 300 foot, those are the interested parties we've identified, will have their ability to speak. The petitioner has a chance to answer their concerns right away, so they don't have to wait and potentially forget anything. And then we open it to the general public, and then back to the petitioner for a rebuttal. This will help you guys identify those people that are interested parties. When we have really controversial cases and there's like 20 people coming, there may be one person within 300 foot and the other 19 are just people who like the topic. One of our challenges as the Plan Commission is to remember we're looking at the specific land use. We're looking at the category of the land use, not who the user is. So whether or not it's good for an office, not whether or not it's good for that particular insurance office. So it's kind of helping us to stay on focus as to what the land use is. We don't get the benefit as staff of saying we do or don't like a person. You can't zone a property based on the person who's asking for it. So we try to focus exclusively on the land use, and not just the land use presented, but any land use that could go into that zoning district. So if somebody's asking for a particular land use, we're thinking 20, 30 years in advance. And if you've been around for a while and you know the story of Pandora Books in the Northeast neighborhood, that's an example of where in 1991 the staff said, maybe an office isn't a good idea here. And then it got turned into an office. And then once it was an office, they had to be able to do anything allowed within the office district, which then the neighbors got really upset about later down the line. So we're always trying to think ahead. We're trying to give you that foresight as well.
And just on that is like what we are really trying to do is you know, us as staff and you as the Plan Commission body, we, you know, I feel like we are the things that help drive the consistency. We can let the former or the new council make the decisions that go against whatever we think. It's, you know, it's up to them to, you know, but I think we should try to keep as much of the politics out of a land use decision as possible. And I think as a Plan Commission, we are able to do that, especially if we act consistently in doing so. The council has in the past done things the way they want to do them, and they don't always agree with what the Plan Commission or the staff say and do, and that's their prerogative. But as long as we feel like we are at least most of the time in line with each other, I think it helps drive consistency for development in the city. And it's one thing that's extremely important. Developers and people who are wanting to do things, they look for consistency. Kyle, correct?
Sure.
You want to know what you can do, and you want to know that can't, you know, that's gonna something that can move through. When things become when things become a little like not unsure, it makes it more difficult and people may choose not to do things, it makes the process a lot harder. So,
do people have to qualify themselves as being within the 300 feet when they come up to the podium? Or, I mean,
yeah, so we'll emphasize that first part, that this is anybody who's received a notice or lives within 300 foot. We have a list because we generate those lists and send out the notifications. So when someone gets up and identifies themselves, we'll be able to quickly check to make sure that the address they're giving is within 300 foot. So we have it in an Excel database, and we can quickly search it. We can rely on the staff to kind of police that for you. And just quickly, because the HPC meets in here in about 15 minutes. So just a reminder, rezonings and special exceptions, we send with a recommendation. You should always try to come to a recommendation. I'm not going to tell you that you don't ever send things with no recommendation, but that should only be used if you come to a complete impasse and you can't get to a quorum vote one way or the other. And that's because when you send it with no recommendation, it kind of undermines your authority with the council, right? Like if you keep sending them stuff with no recommendation, they're going to say, what's the point of the Plan Commission? So we always try to come to a recommendation whenever we can. And then because we have the combined public hearing variances, will stop with you, so that's an approve or deny. And same with subdivisions. The subdivisions are not subjective. Either they meet all the criteria and you approve it, or you approve it with conditions. But very rarely will you ever deny a subdivision. So I can't even think of an instance where I've had a subdivision denied. There may be a waiver that they requested that get denied, which is kind of like a variance, but not the subdivision itself. And then you have the right to place any conditions or commitments on those properties as well. And again, as we're doing the staff reports, we may suggest from time to time, you know, this property may be okay if they put these conditions on there. So that you may see some from us, you may come up with some of your own, or the petitioner may present some because they think it'll make you like it better. So those are kind of the ways they come up. Yes.
When you said that all motions, but then we dropped down to variances and special exceptions. If conditions are placed part of the recommendation, is it still up to the council whether they accept
for them? Variances? No. So for instance, you could approve a variance subject to providing additional screening, or you could amend the variance. Maybe they're asking for a 50-foot height variance and you approve it at 45 foot. So the conditions that they don't be built more than 45 foot, or you may put a condition on it that they set the building back an extra 10 feet to not.
Is that the condition upon which it must be accepted by the council later?
So that doesn't go. That doesn't go to the council.
Well, the variance, okay, special exception.
Right. So if the rezoning, if you approve or deny a variance, it's all the only thing that would happen that the council could impact it is if they didn't approve that zoning, then the variance is no good either. So if someone got a variance for a setback in C commercial and then the council denied the C commercial zoning request, then it would just kind of go away. The really odd ones are when you recommend against a petition, but then you still have to act on the variances, because even though you may send it with an unfavorable recommendation, they still have the right to request those variances in case the council passes it. So there may be a time when you recommend unfavorably on rezoning, but recommend approving the variances, because if the council decides to zone it to C commercial, then you have no problem with the variances that they're requesting. So we'll always be here to walk you through all of those really weird and fun things that are bound to come up as we go along this process.
But those are all after so many months, if nothing happens, those disappear.
Variances, yes. Yes. If they do not act on it within a year, that goes away. Yep.
Who reviews new PUDs? Or
there are no longer PUDs.
There are none. What about current or existing PUDs?
All the existing PUDs were assigned a zoning district. And anything that goes beyond that, so for instance, let's take Niles and Jefferson, used to be a PUD, and now it's zoned downtown with an assumed height variance, because that was really the only difference in the PUD. So anything that they had gotten approved that went beyond the zoning ordinance is an assumed variance or special exception.
Okay.
You guys will be happy those are gone. Those are very complicated. I'm happy they're gone. They're very complicated to administer. So. Other than that, the ordinance is available online, and feel free to call us always.
Yeah, cannot stress that enough. Especially in the beginning stages of this, it is a new ordinance. Some of you might have been familiar with the old ordinance. Those who are not, but are trying to figure this all out, we are definitely more than happy to help answer those questions for you.
And feel free to send people to meet with me as you hear them talking about projects. I'm always happy to sit down and meet with them at a time. And this is a living document. You will probably, in fact, in February, you will likely see some text changes that we're already proposing just in the few months that we've been using it and preparing for what's coming up. So we did have a rezoning filed today. So in February, you will have a rezoning, potentially assuming that they have all their paperwork and they want to proceed. You'll have a rezoning request, probably a text amendment, and 4 or 5 subdivisions. So you have an agenda already for February coming your way. So we'll keep you busy.
Commend you guys on the work again. I know this is not a small effort to significantly reduce a lot of opportunities here. So this is great. Thank you very much.
Not to brag, but our land use consultant, who we hired just to make sure that we didn't do anything illegal, I kept challenging. I go, Angela, can I do this? She's like, no. That's illegal, Tim. And I was like, oh,
all right. Play one.
All right, yeah. But they called this that the rest of the state of Indiana should be looking at this awesome ordinance as a model for other communities around Indiana. So
that's fantastic.
We're quite proud of the work that we've done, but that work is kind of never over in a sense. So the other advantage that we didn't get to talk a whole lot about, but the implementing the Plan Commission has led us down some really interesting paths that we never really thought we were going to go down. But what this meant, though, was that the coordination between planning, engineering, parks, I mean, this is why the composition of this board is the way it is, all right? Building department, even code enforcement, like that coordination and the level of coordination that we are doing now has never been done in at least since 1965. It's never been done, and so there are standards that the Board of Public Works has that are different than the zoning ordinance, or code enforcement has another definition for something. We are coordinating all of those things. There will be one definition.
We're working on it.
So there's a few things that are still kind of out there, but we are working towards, you know, one path, one direct, you know, one definition, you know. So, you know, if we say you can only have one driveway, so does the public works guidelines. And where can you park? So the code enforcement knows not to ticket somebody in some places, but other places, yes. So this level of coordination is great. The plan review process, which is something that we don't necessarily deal with, you guys won't have to deal with because it's not a rezoning. It's something that's by right, but it comes through the building department. We have implemented a software package that allows us to all talk to each other, to sign off on all the different things. So it's going to be a lot harder to slip through the cracks or to play one department off of another department, which never has happened. And it's been a source of frustration, I think, for council at times too, is because there will be something where the building department, issued a permit for a project that didn't meet zoning or didn't meet an engineering standard, and then it gets caught later on, and then you know how this goes. I mean, it just is not good. You know, like everybody's angry. Someone's built something that they shouldn't have done. Historic preservation is another great example. Like, I didn't know I was in a historic district. Well, you know, we've sent out over 1,000 letters to people just to make sure that they do know they're in a historic district. And so it's making it harder and harder for these things to kind of slip through the cracks. So it's been good for us to do this. I'm glad we've had the time to take to do this without the year or so that we've had to sort of help set this up. I think it wouldn't have run as smoothly as it has so far. Knock on wood. So thank you very much.
Thank you.
Thank you
very much. I think we've prosecuted everything on the list. Shall we adjourn?
So moved.
Second.
All right.
We're done.
So we'll see you next month on the fourth floor.
Yeah, please come back.
Sorry, Kyle, I misjudged.
Oh, this morning.
I texted
him. We're restarting the game runs.
So you'll get a preliminary packet from us. Yes. So send an email. Preliminary packet. That will be probably at the end of this week. This is the first one, and then about 10 days before we'll send you the one that has.
Hi, I'm Carol. Sorry.
Angela.
Nice to meet you.
And copy of cookies.
Yes. Sorry. I had to track it down.
Yes. Maybe if you want to
designated. Yes, correct.
Yes.
Exactly.
Okay, good.